Okay, for those who don't know who Scott Stripling is, who is Dr. Scott Stripling?
Well, David, there is a meteorologist by that name. I know because I get his mail all the time. But the one that you're talking to today is the archaeologist. What got me into archaeology was the Bible. And I was a passionate Bible reader. I was involved in ministry, and I was getting ready to do doctoral work, and nothing really excited me except the material culture. I thought some of the things that we struggled to understand, the difficult sayings of Jesus, for example, must lie in the material culture. And that's what led me into reading voraciously, studying, getting involved as a volunteer on archaeological digs, working my way up to the ranks, so to speak, until ultimately, as they say, the inmates are in charge of the asylum. I was actually in charge. Been married for 39 years. I have 4 grown children and 4 grandchildren so far. I've been here at the Bible Seminary for 6 years and love it. We've got 9 master's degrees programs, one of them being in biblical history and archaeology. And we're just in a really neat spot located in a time and in a place where I think we get to engage in the arena of ideas, and that's what I love doing.
Standing here with Scott Stripling at the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas, at the 3J Museum. What are the 3 J's?
David, that's Joshua, Judges, and Jesus.
All right.
Yes.
All right. There's some symmetry to that.
Yeah, that was kind of intentional.
All right. So you've got this free exhibit for anybody that would like to come, and it's in this on the west side or southwest side of Houston. And we'd love to see people come and see what's here because there's some exciting artifacts. Doug, a lot of it by you in Israel. So what am I looking at all around here?
Well, over the last quarter of a century, my teams have excavated a lot of these materials at Kirbit El Makadar, at Ancient Shiloh, and some are on loan from other museums. But we start in the period of Joshua, and we talk about what was the conquest, and where did it happen, and how did it happen, and what did the artifacts show us about it? Mm. And the site that we thought was a good candidate for biblical eye was a site called Kirbit El Makadar, or Makatir, and that's 10 miles north of Jerusalem.
Mm. And so when I look at this chart that you have here, there's a lot of archaeological stuff on it, like Bronze Age and Iron Age and stuff like that.
Right.
It's easier for me to think of Joshua and Judges sometimes than it is, which age am I in?
Exactly. Well, it's important that we get the time period right. We would place Joshua and Moses here in the late Bronze Age, whereas we would have Abraham up here about 1,000 years before David. So Joshua and Judges are right in between Abraham and David, if you want to think of it like that.
You've got some great artifacts. We're looking right here at a big stone. This is bigger than most mortar and pedestals I've seen.
Okay, I carried this off the site, so
did
I can
you
tell
really?
You it's heavy.
It looks like about 300 pounds.
I didn't say it was easy. This is a socket stone from the gate at Ai, and this is the lower socket. This is the upper socket. So this would be up top with a wooden post connecting them, and then the door pivots on the post. And you can see that it's worn all the way through there.
Ah.
And guess what they do with those when they wear all the way through?
But replace them? I don't know.
They become toilets.
Oh, they do?
They become,
wonderful.
Think of Lachish. One was found in Lachish this last year. In Jerusalem, the house of Ahiel has one. So when they wear through, you repurpose them.
I'm thinking there's a lot of friction, that big piece of wood moving around there.
Well, and a faith lesson is Proverbs says that a lazy man turns on his bed like a door pivots on its post. So, in other words, he doesn't actually get out of bed. He just keeps turning over. This helps us remember that.
All right. In 2013, I think it's Christianity Today described one of your finds as the most important archaeological find of that year.
Well, that's right. And it's a little bitty find, David, called a scarab. And a scarab is a beetle, shape of a beetle. And you can see him over here to our left.
And this is the real thing. This is
the
not
the actual scarab.
Wow,
this is the scarab of Amenhotep II. And he is from the 15th century BC. And so when we found that scarab by this student, this is a TBS graduate here in this picture.
Young lady. Yeah, like she went to
Destry with you. Jackson, and she was working with us. She very expertly noted him in context, right above bedrock. That enabled us to confirm the dating of our pottery, because all we had for dating metrics at that point, because no coins exist yet, and we had not gotten good carbon dates. So this was a second dating metric, and that's why it became so important.
I'm looking at some other things here. What do we want to look at? What do we want to focus on?
Yeah, well, first let me point out what he looks like. So in his scarab, right. Look, you've got the head of a falcon, the body of a lion. So it's a depiction of Pharaoh, okay? He's the lord of heaven and earth. The falcon rules the sky, the lion rules the earth, the Neter, deity symbol, and then life. So sort of Pharaoh is the lord of heaven and earth, and he's the source of all life. These are important because the iconography is not used by previous administrations or by subsequent administrations. So it's a really good metric for dating.
So it helps you to understand exactly which pharaoh this is referring to out of all
that. And then we can synchronize that. If it's found in Israel in a clean archaeological context, we can synchronize the material.
Was there a traitor in Israel who was secretly working for the Egyptians?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody's playing both sides in the late Bronze Age.
Yeah, I figured as much.
Read the Amarna letters. They're all doing it. Yeah, right. And next to this, we've got some sling stones, and we found hundreds of these. Feel how heavy that is, David. Heavier than you expected, right?
Yeah, heavier. What's it made out of?
It's flint.
Flint.
So that's why it sort of surprised you. And this is a military-grade sling stone. This is not what David used with Goliath, okay? Mm-hmm. This is military-grade. We found hundreds of these. A trained slinger throws this 150 miles an hour. Now, when Nolan was pitching for the Strohs, on a good day, he threw it 100.
Yeah, maybe. Okay? Maybe.
And if you got hit, you were in trouble.
Right.
Imagine being hit by this at 150.
That's about five times heavier than a baseball.
It'll take you out.
Yeah.
Okay, so these...
So this is real military grade stuff.
These are military grade, and we found them at many, many sites all throughout Israel, so we know what it is. And we have some stones from the Elah Brook on the other side, and that you can contrast those with what they were using of military grade versus what David just had to mm-hmm. get out of the brook.
Hmm. Wow, it's fascinating. That is super heavy.
I know.
Wow. Now, Scott, this looks to be a little bit smaller than a baseball.
Right, but heavier.
Heavier.
Okay,
a lot heavier.
So, yeah, that's a good analogy, about the size of a baseball. But notice how it's a little bit squarish, how it fits in your hands. Feel it again.
Yeah.
So
I can feel that. You can grab it really well.
When they're not at war, though, and most of the time they're not at war, these become pounders. Hmm. So in your kitchen, you got pounders to crack nuts and soften meat and so forth. Hmm. Of course, when a siege comes, everything in the kitchen becomes a weapon, including these.
Including those things, yeah. And you had a lot of stone items in the kitchen, too.
Well, that's right. Absolutely.
Now, this is an offering vessel. That's how you describe this next piece.
Right. How did the Canaanites understand the afterlife? Quite frankly, we don't know. I mean, we understand their pantheon of gods, but when somebody died, how did they see moving from this world to the next? When we find infant burials, David, the jars look like this. They have a hole cut in the bottom like this, and there's a dipper juglet next to them like this.
A dipper juglet.
Hundreds of examples like this have been found in the Bronze Age. So when we found this juglet and then saw the dipper juglet next to it, we were very careful, assuming there would be bones, and there were. And you can see here the bones of a neonate, a newborn. Now, this is important because the Bible says there were women at the fortress of Ai, and some have questioned that, like, why would women be at a military fortress? Of course, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that, according to Marina Fairman, anthropologist at Hebrew University, these are bones of a neonate, so apparently there were women at the fortress.
And there's a lot of infant mortality in those days, right?
Even up to modern times, high infant mortality rates and a lot of women dying in childbirth, so this is not a surprise that so many of these have been found.
Is this particular kind, what is it made out of, and how would you describe its size?
Okay, this clay jar is typical of the late Bronze Age, and it's about 2.5 feet high and about 1.5 feet wide, and the rim everts, and that's typical of the late Bronze. We would date this to late Bronze I time period, late Bronze 1B. And it's very interesting, though, that style cycles back around. And in the late Hellenistic period, which is 1,000 years later, it's almost identical. Sort of like ties come back in, pottery type cycle.
I love those wide ties, didn't you?
I still have mine.
Yeah.
So you have to then go to secondary factors to date it, like the inclusions of the clay and things like that. But this is typical of that time period.
And so the baby's remains would be laid inside of that. Would it be buried? Would there be a burial?
Well, again, we don't understand their whole cult, but there must have been, because the dipper juglets are always there. So I think they probably poured water or oil or something over the body of the baby as sort of a preparation for the afterlife.
Now, you've been digging up Kerbet El Mekater for a number of years.
Was it 21 years.
21 years.
The excavation lasted, and that's what archaeology is. You know, it's not that you go in with a bullwhip like Indiana Jones and get the artifact and the girl and take off. You know, it's a slow, careful scientific process. From beginning to end, 21 years, and now 5 years of publication work. Finally, now our volumes of publication are coming out in the next few months, volumes 1 and 2 on the dig.
Where do you think we are with Kerbet El Mekater?
Well, we felt like at that point, 2016, that we had answered our research questions. We thought there were 15 criteria that we needed to check off that a site would need to have. We felt like it checked it off and that we were going to make as good of a case as could be made. I mean, we never found a city limit sign that said, welcome to I, but we did find a lot of verisimilitude between the text and the material culture. We publish it now and everybody can argue and decide, you know, how that fits into the whole compendium of things.
Have scholars been amenable to that, or have they pushed back?
Sure. Well, both. I mean, we have the saying where there are two archaeologists, there are three opinions. And so, you know, we're an opinionated group. But I would say that it's a divided, which is much better than where we were when we started with 0% of the opinion. So I think many people have accepted Kerbet El Mekater as I. Others haven't read the final volumes yet, and they're waiting to look at the evidence. And then others, you know, probably will not think that that's the site.
So you have a number of artifacts here related to that. Where are most of the artifacts?
Okay, most of them are in Israel in the Antiquities Authority. We have our own storage unit there. And so our excavations at Kerbet Nisya, Kerbet Makatir, and now at Shiloh and Mount Ebad. So 4 projects. And so our artifacts are all stored there in an organized fashion so that we can access them whenever we need them.
Are they photographed when you find them, or are they photographed by the Israeli Antiquities Authority?
Unless they're super important, then they don't go back and re-photograph. We shoot everything before we turn it in. And then sometimes we have to go get it out again and reshoot it if we're going to publish a certain item. But unless it's something of tremendous significance, they don't actually photograph it.
All right, you were in the period of the judges. That's a little bit after the time of Joshua.
The site was vacant for a couple hundred years. And they came along, they being some early Israelites in the Iron Age I, and they dug into the massive fortification wall. It was 4 meters wide, and so they dug into it and built their houses in there. And you can see what they look like, these small primitive houses about the size of a 10-by-10 storage room or something like that.
And they lived most of their indoor lives there, but most of their lives are spent outdoors.
Absolutely. Now, they probably had tents that were pitched out here, so it's kind of semi-nomadic still at this point. But these are small, primitive, and everything you see in that picture, David, we excavated, including the roof roller. I mean, not the lady down there, but everything else.
Everything else.
And this big guy right here, who we call Big Ben.
Oh, this is a massive jar here.
I mean, this guy is my favorite, I have to tell you. And I named him Ben because our site's in the tribe of Benjamin territory. Mm. And so he's left-handed, obviously. And Bible readers will pick up on
that.
Yeah,
okay?
But Ben was found inside this house right over here. And he was probably used for wet storage initially, but as he began to develop cracks, probably then used for dry storage.
Hey, when you say wet storage, you mean?
Water, because we did not have a spring on site or a well on site. Hmm. So they did a lot of hauling of water or filling when it did rain. So, you know, they'd try to keep Ben full of water most of the time. Once they no longer can hold water, then they use them for dry storage, grains and, you know, wheats and stuff like that. And you can mend them. We have many examples of them drilling, once a jar breaks, drilling and sewing it back together so it can still be used for dry storage.
Really? I've never seen that before.
I'll show you some examples of it.
And so they drill through it.
They drill on both sides of the crack.
And then they sew it together so it holds together.
For dry storage. Right. You know, not for
now, you've had to restore this not once, but a couple of times, right?
Ben was in about 120 pieces when we found him. And so we put him together in Israel. We shipped him over here on a tanker. And when he arrived, he was back into 13 pieces. And so then we had to reconstruct him again. But this was a great learning experience for our students, of course. And they're going to learn how to meld pottery. And as you know, at the Lanier a couple of years ago, we did a pottery workshop there and teaching folks how to do these things. But it also reminds us of sort of what the Bible says about broken jars, how we resemble broken jars and how God can mend us and put us back together.
Now, when I look at the bottom here, I notice that there's like a point to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to sit up on the ground very easily.
Okay, so this is a good point. They had jar stands, big jar stands, ceramic usually, or when we found him, he's dug into the clay probably 2 feet in.
Okay, so the hole was to be dug, they're buried.
That's
awful. Why didn't they put a flat bottom on there?
Okay, it's more susceptible to break. So let's say you and I are carrying him, it's got a flat bottom, and then we set him down. Just in the act of setting him down, there's the potential for breaking him each time. Where if it's a pointed bottom, he can set into a jar stand, which is contoured, and then there's less impact.
Is there a name for this kind of jar?
Yeah, this is called, it's a pithos, a large storage jar. But we call this a collared rim jar. And this is the classic Iron Age I Israelite collared rim jar. And you can see why. He's got a beautiful collar on him.
Almost like a turtleneck.
This is the classic turtleneck rim jar. You've just renamed.
Can I rename that?
You just
is that okay
came up with a new classification, a new nomenclature. David, when you find collared rim jars and four-room houses and no pig bones, guess what you've got?
Israelites.
You've got Israelites, okay? So this is one of the telltale signs.
This is one of the signs, and you mentioned pig bones.
Yeah.
Give us more about that.
So the stratum beneath this stratum at Kirbit al-Makadr has 4% pig bone, because we test every bone, every seed, and we track all of this. So it's 4% pig bones. We know what their diet was. When we get into this level, we've got 0% pig bone.
So they're not eating pork.
Absolutely. There's a biblical prohibition against pork. It's reflected in the material culture.
So material culture sort of verifies that these Jews are trying to be, or these Israelites are trying to be observant at that point.
That's right. And same thing in Second Temple period. We've got 0% pig bone in those particular areas. So it's very interesting. There's no other explanation. And this is why the Bible is our go-to source in that part of the world. I mean, we try to, in some cases, the Egyptian literature is helpful or the Mesopotamian literature is helpful. But let's face it, we're in the highlands of Israel. The Bible is our go-to source.
All right. Big Ben is a big fella. How big is Big Ben?
He's about 4 feet tall, and you can see that he's
made out of clay.
Made completely out of clay from the Jerusalem area, Rencina-type soil. As you pointed out, he's got a pointed bottom, a collared rim, and then he's got matching handles on the shoulder, halfway down on the shoulder on either side. And his color is a beautiful orangish with a little pinkish hue.
Now, as I look down in there, I see black.
Okay,
is that original or is that something
that? No, this was some restoration material. I told you that he'd fallen apart a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But for an old guy, okay, he's 3,100 years old. He's had some work.
Yeah.
This sort of is like his denture cream to help him hold together a little bit.
That keeps him together. Yeah. I see two handles on the side as well.
Yeah, and we would describe that as being on the shoulder of the vessel. Mm-hmm. And so if you and I were carrying him in ancient times, you would have one handle, I would have the other, and we would carry him off.
Now, what does Big Ben weigh? Do you know approximately?
Yeah, he weighs in pounds, it would be about 50 pounds.
50 pounds. Yeah, okay, so, not as much as I thought looking at him like that, but it's a jar that stands about 4 feet tall, something like that.
Yeah.
Also, he is a big fellow.
And oftentimes we test the clay. You can see the inclusions here, these large inclusions in the clay. That's typical of the Iron One. And the holes like this, can you see that hole?
I can,
Those are all over the vessel. Those are organic inclusions that have fallen out over time.
Okay.
Or they've decomposed or fallen out.
So by organic, when you say occlusion.
An inclusion, like
inclusion,
something
okay.
like a wood, a piece of wood or part of a seed or something like that.
Over time that decays because it's carbon-based.
And it leaves these pockmarks in the vessel. Mm. That's typical of that time period, not the one before and not the one after. So we often test the clay. We do what's called neutron activation analysis. And so we take the clay, and we can test it, and it will tell us where it came from in the world. Is it from the Jerusalem area? Was it imported? This will especially help you tell if it's an imported vessel or not. Now, these are never imported, these collar-brim jars, but we often want to know where the vessel came from.
If they were imported.
Yeah, because that can help us understand trade relationships in the ancient world. We've got a vessel from Turkey. Well, this is telling us something. Mm-hmm. You know, there must have been some trade relationship going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this lamp, when David said, "This is a you, God, are a lamp unto my feet." This is the lamp that he had in mind.
The lamps that we looked at earlier are from Abraham's time, the quad lamp, or from Jesus' time, what we call the Herodian-style lamp. David didn't know what those were. Mm. He didn't know what Abraham's lamp looked like or what Jesus' lamp looked like. This is what he had in mind. This is Iron Age 2A when he gets this inspiration and he writes, "Your word, O Lord, is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." This is what he envisions. Mm. And the juglet next to it is where they would carry oil. I mean, you have to carry oil with you so you can fill your lamp.
So you carry enough oil with you for not only today, but maybe tomorrow as well, or late into the evening, I guess.
Think about the Good Samaritan. I mean, he has oil with him. He pours oil and wine into the wounds of this man. So it's a very common thing to carry oil.
Let's talk about the physical properties of the lamp here.
Okay. If we look at the bottom, you can see a foot. And so that's raised about almost an inch.
Yeah.
And we call it a foot. Okay. So it's not flat, and that's good because it doesn't rock.
Back and
if you've got a lamp with olive oil in it and a wick and it's moving, then
not
that's
good.
Not so good. Right. So this gives it more stability, having that foot. Mm-hmm. And it has a folded ledge in the back and then a pinched nozzle in the front. And you can see where the wick was, where it's burned.
Yeah, you can see the burn marks from it. Yeah.
So, you know, the morphology of the lamps changes in each time period, and this one is quite diagnostic to the time of David.
And this is one that you and your team dug up.
Yeah, it's a beauty, isn't it?
It is a beauty.
I
love the little juglet right there, too, as well.
The juglet, by the way, that's burnishing. That sheen, that's what we call burnish.
Hmm.
So they would take a stick or a bone or a soft piece of pottery, something like that, and just shine it, just rub it until it came to a sheen. That's hand burnishing. Now, they could also do wheel burnishing, but this is an example of hand burnishing.
Tell us a little bit about this particular piece. I've not seen one with it's a juglet, small juglet, but it has a rim or something on the outside, a spigot almost, and it's got eight little holes in it. What are we looking at?
David, this is what you call a beer jug.
A beer jug.
They drank a lot of beer in biblical times. Barley was a big crop, you know.
Right.
And so the barley, when it ferments and you pour it through here, this is intended to strain out the chunks of barley pretty much out of your drink. And the reason that these are so popular is a book called How Beer Saved the World. They had intestinal problems from bad water all the time. Mm. Well, to make beer, you have to boil it. And in the boiling process, you kill the microorganisms. So they noticed that when they drank beer, they didn't have tummy problems. They may have had headaches the next day, but they didn't have tummy problems, at least. So there was a lot of beer consumed in that time period. And we were looking at military-grade sling stones. These are from the Elah Brook. So
the same brook that David took out stones in slaying Goliath.
But notice the difference. Those are military grade. These are common.
These are about the size of a big walnut, it looks like.
A big walnut.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, at 150 miles an hour, if David gets a headshot on Goliath, that's all it's going to take.
Yeah. He's got to be pretty good with it, though, right?
But you know
what? He was pretty practiced, I would imagine.
If you did that all the time, I bet you were accurate with those things. We've got studies from the ancient world, and even on Sennacherib's palace, on the walls, you see slingers as part of his army. Sources say that up to 200 meters they were accurate.
Wow.
A trained slinger.
That's like an arrow.
Yeah.
You know, or better than an arrow, probably.
Two football fields. Yeah. Away, so it's phenomenal.
Yeah. Now, we've made a turn in the museum to more of the kind of the intertestamental period or the period right before the time of Jesus and the apostles. We've got some coins here. Are these coins that you guys have found along the way?
In fact, we excavated 1,322 coins at Kirbet El Makadr, and here you've got some really interesting ones, coins of Herod the Great, Pontius Pilate, Agrippa, Festus, Felix, all the rulers mentioned in the New Testament. Every one of them, Nero, Claudius, you name it, we have their coin.
And why is that important, having the coins from these periods?
Well, you sometimes hear people talk about the biblical literature like it's mythology. And it's not that there isn't mythology. We're going to see in the next section, there is some pagan mythology that's in the background of the culture. But what I tell people at this section is we're talking about real people, real places, and real events. Okay, mm-hmm. Pontius Pilate existed.
Yeah.
Herod the Great existed. Festus existed. We know this.
Yeah. I love finding coins in my sofa, you know, that have just kind of crept down there. But a lot of times you look at the date and say, oh, I must have lost this coin in 1978.
This is a good point, David. But if it had been a gold coin or a silver coin, you would have gone looking for it.
Right.
So of our 1,322 coins, two were gold, five were silver. Everything else was bronze. So
wow.
Do you see how rare silver and gold were?
Yeah.
You would have gone after the coin if it was silver and gold, but you didn't because it was just a quarter.
Right.
Think about the story Jesus told in Luke 15 about a lost son, a lost sheep, and a lost coin. Behold, there was a woman who had 10 silver coins. Now, how does that change it? We know the ratios.
Yeah, that's an amazing ratio.
No wonder. It was nighttime. She lit lamps. It couldn't wait till tomorrow. She notified the neighbors of a crisis, got down on her hands and knees. And, of course, his point is that we are the coin.
Yeah.
And we're of great value, and he's
searching
this out.
Seeking this out.
But that's how the material culture illuminates the biblical text. Mm. Yeah.
We're looking here at, I guess, the head of Alexander the Great. Where was this found?
Okay, this is a replica.
Oh, this is a replica.
I was going to make you a really good deal on it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, good.
90% of the artifacts here are authentic, but there's a few replicas, and this is Alex. But we have him here to sort of let the folks know as they come through how central he was in helping us get from the Old Testament to the New Testament.
I think I've seen him in the British Museum.
He's everywhere. He loved his image. He's even in a synagogue in Hukuk, on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, where Jody Magnus is excavating. The Jewish synagogue has images of Alexander in it.
Really?
He's everywhere.
Wow.
Even the statues of Zeus start looking like him.
I'd like to have my picture made with him, maybe. Would that be better?
I think you and I both should do this.
So
we'll be triplets, because he thought he was the best-looking guy that there had ever been. Well, he comes from a good stock. His father, Philip of Macedon, is a big guy in the ancient world. Macedonia, Philippi is named after him, and he wants to make sure that his son gets a good education. So he hires a tutor for him, not Socrates, not Plato, but Aristotle. So Aristotle then is the tutor of Alexander. Alexander conquers the world in 332. It's divided up among his four generals, two of whom become powerful, the Seleucids in the north, the Ptolemies in the south. Israel's caught in the middle in a tug of war. This leads into a conflict of forced conversion on the Jews. They rebel, and that gives us Hanukkah around 167, 164, the Maccabean War. And ultimately, they achieve independence, and that then sort of gets us ready for the world of the New Testament.
Well, there's a common language now linking it all together.
Right.
Rather than dialects, thousands of dialects, everybody has, if they're going to be in business, they've got to be able to deal some in Greek.
Jesus is probably most comfortable in Aramaic, he and the disciples, but the New Testament is translated into Greek. I don't think they were thinking it in Greek, but it's certainly translated so that the whole Mediterranean world can benefit from it. And I'd point out one other thing on the map is that the Mediterranean Sea is full of pirates up until Julius Caesar. And so if you're in business shipping grain from North Africa across the Mediterranean, you've got a huge problem because pirates are stealing your loads and stealing your ships. So it's not until Julius Caesar clears the Sea of Pirates. Alexander has sort of given the beginnings of the Pax Romana, what's going to become the Pax Romana. So then the disciples ultimately can travel land and sea pretty safely with a language that everyone understands.
Only occasionally finding a brigand and a bandit here or there.
That's right. But it's nothing like it was before that.
Yeah.
So yeah, this kind of gets us from the Old into the New Testament.
That ends part one of our conversation with Scott Stripling at the 3J exhibit, Joshua, Judges, and Jesus. It's on display at the Bible Seminary in the Houston area throughout 2022. Part two is coming up. Thanks to Janet Seaford and Kathy Capes for helping us produce this podcast. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. If you like what you hear, then please subscribe to the Stone Chapel podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Tell a friend about us, and thanks for listening.